The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. It's time again for a book club with our good friend Angelo Giardino. Welcome back, Angelo.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back. It's after Labor Day, and it's time to get a lot done.
We're still talking virtually. Remember how quaint it was, hoping we could make it through a couple of weeks or a couple of months of quarantine?
Yes, exactly. And we're at 7 months, I think, now.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, to live in historic times.
Yeah, right. 2020 was quite a challenging year, and we still have a few more months left.
Well, when I read about them tracking that asteroid and they said, don't worry, it only has a 1% chance of hitting the Earth. 1% times 2020 equals, get under your desk and cover your head.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
How's the quarantine treating you?
We're ever adaptable, I must admit. Every challenge brings some opportunity. And I will say, the fact that I've learned how to do all these meetings via Zoom or WebEx or Citrix has been amazing. And the fact that essentially overnight we learned how to do telehealth has been amazing to me.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is in some ways it's one of those forced paradigm shifts that I think there are probably a lot of things that we've learned because we've had to, but we've learned that there are actually some advantages in some of the things we do, both in medicine and outside.
I agree.
Have you found any source of personal fun and fulfillment during this time that you've not been able to socialize as much?
Well, we live in a beautiful state. So Utah is absolutely beautiful. So just walking around in this wilderness that we live in has just been absolutely affirming. And it really does comport with social distancing rules. So it's really good.
If you're going to be away from other people, being in the grandeur of nature and the variety of landscapes that we have, it's really quite remarkable, isn't it?
I agree.
All right. Well, you brought a very interesting book for us to read today, Team of Teams, by General Stanley McChrystal, and ultimately giving credit as well to the McChrystal Group. A couple of things that I wanted to comment about this. First of all, I thought it was fascinating that the introduction to this book is written by Walter Isaacson, a guy who has spent his career exploring innovation, really, a guy who wrote really probably the definitive biography of Steve Jobs and of Leonardo da Vinci and a great book about Einstein and Ben Franklin. So it's interesting that he's the person that we're called on to lead us into the story. Tell us about the story. Now, when we say team of teams, we're not talking about a superlative team, but rather, well, we are in some ways, but also talking about the idea of collaboration of teams.
Exactly. And I think that's the secret sauce that I would tell the folks listening, if you read this book, you really do have to make an investment in reading it from page one to the end, because it's written in a very nuanced way in that there's stories that are woven through all of the chapters. So to really understand the point they're making, you do have to kind of read it in sequence and you have to read it totally, but it's well worth the investment.
And if you're thinking that you're going to get a management style and technique that's derived entirely from General McChrystal's West Point education, you're in for a surprise.
No, exactly. I think what's really fascinating to me about the book is that he really does use his experience in Iraq and Afghanistan and fighting terrorism to explain management principles. You know, when people first hear about this book, it's like, what would a book about essentially the military have to have any relevance to pediatricians? But when you read the book, you realize healthcare is a team sport as well. And there's very, very strong culture around the teams that have to work together in healthcare. Just like in the military, the SEALs working with the CIA, working with military intelligence, those kind of cultural teams really are reflected just like in healthcare. You know, we have the physician group, we have the nursing group, we have the administrators, we have the hospitals, we have the payer community, and we have kind of like the insurance companies that get to set some of the rules, but then we have our practices that have to work with both the hospitals and the payers. So in some ways, it is actually relevant. And I think we could talk about that if you'd like.
Absolutely, because we've learned both, in medicine and in what happens, say, for instance, in the intelligence community, that that working in silos does not work to the general benefit of the team. So tell us, so you just made the argument that we need to read this 250-page book to understand it. So why don't you give us the capsule view? Sure. Which is easier than done, maybe.
Yeah. So I'll do it really quickly. But essentially, in the military, there's this concept that we live in a VUCA world, V-U-C-A. The world is volatile, it's uncertain, it's complex, and it's ambiguous. So, you know, and you can imagine if you're in charge of a team of soldiers who are in a battle, that's quite a VUCA situation, right? You know, it's volatile, it's uncertain, it's complex, and it's ambiguous. And the key thing about working in a VUCA world in the military is that you have to be very clear about the fact that there's such a thing as called commander's intent. Like, we want to occupy that city, for example. Mm-hmm. And then there's this notion that you have to delegate the actual tactics of achieving that intent to the group of soldiers that are on the ground, because it's so volatile, because it's so uncertain, because it's complex and ambiguous. The leaders in Washington, D.C., cannot be making the decisions on that battlefield. There has to be a really well-trained group of folks that know how to achieve that aim. And that's kind of the crux of the book, this notion of allowing adaptability at the front line and actually having enough trust and confidence in the people that you put in the front line that they're gonna achieve the goal and that they don't need to be micromanaged. So think about that for a minute. Everybody, whether you're in the military or in healthcare, none of us want to be treated like a widget. We don't want to be a widget. We don't want to think that we're interchangeable, and we're not. So if you as a leader can get the idea that you're not managing widgets, you're actually leading intelligent people who hopefully you've well-trained, and hopefully you've given them the skills and the judgment to be able to make decisions on the fly that are going to get us to what we want, which obviously in healthcare is high quality care, you know, a really good patient experience, making really good judgments to do the right thing. If you as a leader are in a system where you have some confidence in the people at the front line, you actually have to do something that's not 100% intuitive. Your leadership has to be you stepping back a little bit and letting the people in the front line actually do their job. And that, you know, you have to see as a leader, are you comfortable doing that? And I think General McChrystal in this book kind of articulates how he got to that point with his military operation. And I just thought that was really empowering. So I'd be interested if you thought that same way.
It did, absolutely. And one of the things I think was that is so instructive about this is in the case of military management, the thing that you're trying to accomplish is generally to address a force that is also applying strategy and intelligence. Yes. to counter what it is that you're trying to do. And so, you know, if we're looking at the coronavirus has, you know, one mission, one ability, it's really good at what it does. It's moderately predictable, but in the case of a military action, your foe is designed to be unpredictable. And I thought that was very, very interesting, this idea of, you know, contrasting his forces with the forces of Al-Qaeda that were not as well funded, not as well trained, but had both a dedication to what they were doing and this granular adaptability that made them so effective.
Yeah, I think that's a key point. This notion of adaptability, and again, it's not like this is the first time that's been said. So, you know, it's attributed to Darwin. He said, the species that's the smartest, the species that's the strongest, isn't always the one that survives. The one that survives is the one that's most adaptable. And that's particularly true, I think, in management. If you are holding to a strategy that as you're trying to implement it, you see that it's not working. If you hold tight to that and can't make a change, you're not going to survive.
Right. Even though it seems completely unfair.
And think about it, Paul, in terms of the coronavirus, like you just said, you know, when we were, you know, we've only known about this virus since like January, I think. I mean, right. I wasn't even thinking about it till February. So, you know, so think about it. Like we've gone from knowing that there's this virus, to then figuring out that it's spread primarily through asymptomatic individuals. Therefore, we need to have non-pharmacologic methods to address it. And then we've kind of hit upon the fact, like, actually, if you want to keep it at bay, you have to wear a mask and you have to socially distance and you have to wash your hands 1,000 times a day.
Right.
That wasn't the exact message in January.
Right. And one of the frustrations that we hear, I think, from especially from people who are not medical is why does the narrative keep changing?
And the answer is, and it's because science happens in pieces. And as you learn the evidence, you should change your mind.
Right, right. Which is exactly what Dr. McChrystal, General McChrystal, well, let's make him a doctor for the case of the...
An honorary one. Let's confer a doctorate on him.
Yeah, we'll bestow an honorary doctorate from the virtual curbside.
Yes.
He'll be thrilled.
We'll let him know.
But yeah, that's the point, right? So in his model, there's a difference between a team, as we traditionally think about teams, and a team the way he thinks about teams. Tell us what your take on that is.
So he uses the idea that all of those groups that he's talking about actually have an approach towards teaming, towards creating their own teams. You know, so the CIA, the SEALs, the Army Rangers, they all have a way of becoming a team, and it's quite effective. And, you know, just a little bit of military history. A lot of this work came out of the disaster in the Iranian hostage crisis in 79, where our rescue attempt failed in the desert. And that was called, I think, Operation Eagle Claw. And it just was such a failure. The plan did not come together and it wasn't adaptable. So when they confronted obstacles, it didn't work. And what the whole military complex has worked on is getting those very good teams that are good individually within their silo, getting them to work collectively across the silo. And if you think about that, that's the team of teams. So when you can get, in his case, the CIA, the NSA, the Rangers, and the SEALs to work together as a finely tuned machine, that's the team of teams. And he has a whole approach of how you build credibility and trust. And the way you really do build trust is ultimately by trusting everyone to share information in a way that's going to convince them that by working together, they're going to achieve more than if they work separately. So this notion of transparency, of mutual respect, of sacrificing for the greater good, really, in his case, really shows that this one vehicle that they used, this management vehicle, this operational briefing that they held, which, you know, in 2005 was kind of pretty novel to have a video-capable operational briefing that essentially got all of these different groups from a global perspective to kind of call in every day and hear about what intelligence did the United States have that day?
Yeah.
And then how are we going to use it? But think about it. We have that in healthcare now. So like in the patient safety realm, I would say just about all of our hospitals have a daily operational briefing, and all of the different teams in the hospital send a representative, and you find out what went wrong in the past 24 hours, what are the concerns for the next 24 hours, and what can we do right now to address that concern? You know, that came from this Team of Teams book, you know, that whole notion of having an operational briefing. So it really is exciting to see how this has diffused over to healthcare. And I think for us, let's say that have responsibility for practices, it really speaks to the fact that we have to be thinking about the different organizations, the different disciplines that we need to work with on a daily basis to collaborate. And rather than treat them with suspicion, let's think about how to connect to them, learn a little bit more about their priorities, and then figure out how to be collaborative. And that takes a little bit of time. But if you've had any of these experiences where you start to form a team of teams, once you see that work, you never go back. And you buy into this McChrystal concept that by being transparent, by acting in good faith, you can actually advance the mission, if you will, much further if you work together than if you stay in your silo and just kind of with brute force try to push forward.
If you look at his organizational chart, it's a much different look, isn't it? And the commander in his chart, in the traditional chart, is very top down.
Yes.
But in a team of teams, there's all this cross collaboration, and it really makes membership on a team much more meaningful, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you know, the examples he uses really are quite thoughtful, and he uses examples from other industries. But what the airline industry has learned with crew resource management is that anybody on that aircraft who sees an error about to happen is absolutely empowered to get that information up the chain so that the folks flying the plane can use that information. And we certainly have learned that in healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. So in an operating room, it may very well be the scrub tech who sees that we're about to operate on the wrong limb. And because there was that initial briefing and everybody knows you're supposed to operate on the right limb rather than the left limb or vice versa, whoever sees that the surgeon is about to make the incision on the incorrect limb is empowered and actually required to say stop. Mm-hmm. So we've learned that. And I think you could use this in management more and more, because a lot of times the folks at the front desk are quite tied in to how the day is going. And if they feel empowered to let you know that the patients are stacking up or there's an issue going on, they then can bring that forward and you can have a much more effective day.
Right, and one of the things I think is a slow culture shift, but I think has been very meaningful, is the idea of looking at how a team can be empowered to fix this as opposed to just finger pointing and saying, look at this bad thing you've done. You got a command from the top. You should have made this happen. But what he makes clear is that you have, even a smart, well-trained commander doesn't know everything that's happening in the front.
Exactly. And the other point that he makes kind of at a more macro level is because we now have all of this information technology, we are flooded with information. So it really is folly for a leader to think that they are plugged in and actually have heard everything that they need to hear. So that's just not going to happen when you have a 24-hour news feed.
Right.
And you know, you can just type something into the internet and you're talking to somebody across the world. So you have to understand the 21st century, because of information technology, is not what the 20th century was.
I've often said that the 24-hour news cycle is like a generated electronic record, more words, less meaning.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. There you are, the optimist.
Always. So one of the things I think is very interesting is he talks about how you get teams to be incentivized to collaborate, because the stress is always for a team to become more protective of what they're doing, more competitive, and then the silo is back. So tell us a little bit about how he talks about incentivizing collaboration.
Well, again, I think that really revolves around giving people experiences where they see that by having more access and understanding the way the other team works, you can actually get in a groove, if you will, and work synergistically almost automatically. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you get a great deal of satisfaction from knowing that you actually effectively achieve the work. And this is really, there's two schools of thought, right? So there's one school of thought that says you can't trust the frontline folks, and the and you really kind of have to create structures and kind of almost like cattle chutes that they're going to do everything the way you want them to, versus the other school of thought that says actually most people that work want to do a good job, and if you give them experiences where they see how to achieve a good job, that's going to be enough motivation. And they don't actually need you breathing down their neck every minute of the day. They actually could be trusted. And that trust builds more trust. And he did some things, I think, to engender that trust. So one thing he did that I thought was quite, you know, for a military person, he's a general, is that whenever a junior person was going to present on that operational briefing that essentially was being broadcast to some very powerful people all over the world, his staff would make sure that he knew the person's first name, and he would greet them with their first name, which to a junior staffer, that a four-star general knows your name is like a big deal. So imagine if the chair of surgery knows the name of the scrub tech. You know, that's going to really make you feel like the team. And it's really a good thing to do.
And to be honest, I know the name of the housekeeper.
Exactly.
Because success hinges on everyone doing their job. One of the stories I loved from that was where he sent, I believe it was a Navy SEAL in plain clothes to work in an embassy. And they gave him nothing to do. They said, "You got nothing that you can offer us." And he said, "I'll take out your garbage."
Yeah.
And so in taking out their garbage, he learned, for instance, that one of the staffers loved Chick-fil-A. So he made sure that lots of Chick-fil-A got shipped in. And over time, then the ambassador was willing to say, "Well, wait a minute, what can you offer us on this?" He said, "Boy, do I have something I can offer on this." But overcoming those natural tendencies that we have to only trust people with our same point of view and our own training is enormous.
Yeah. And I think the point there, Paul, is you do, if you want to build trust and then know that ultimately it's going to work out, right? Is you have to be humble enough to say, "Hey, these people have no idea that I'm like a top-notch intelligence officer. So I'll just take out their trash and get them some Chick-fil-A." But the second, in an adaptable system, the second I'm going to be useful to them, it's going to work. So, you know, you have to eat a little humble pie for a while and essentially serve, and eventually it's going to work. And if you think about that, that actually is a core value in healthcare, right? Because we do want to serve the patient. And I just found that this book is kind of very applicable to healthcare, in that we have core values that really relate to not needing to be the smartest person in the room, but we do want to be the most effective person in the room.
And we rely on our team, because that chief of surgery is not going to be able to do any operations without the scrub tech or, quite frankly, without the housekeeping staff.
Yeah. And again, now that we're in the 21st century, that chief of surgery is going to feel a lot better at the end of the day if they did not operate on the wrong limb.
Right. Right. We all will.
Yeah.
As a system, we will. We all gain when any part of the system gains.
Yes. Yeah. So again, I do think it's well worth the read. And I think he summarized, and his team, because he wrote this book as a team.
Right.
Did a really good job at pulling some of the interesting stories that support it. And it really makes sense. And I find it quite empowering.
I have to give a shout out to a couple of groups in the process. Number one, I think it's wonderful what the Utah AAP is doing in this regard, because we're trying to make this, you know, an intersection where people can come and share ideas and share things that they do. And you know, Lisa Stoddard has done a ton to help facilitate that. And, you know, I'm not the president anymore, so, you know, don't claim to take any credit at all. But I look at, for instance, some of the things that Neil Davis has done, bringing people together from what could be seen as competing groups to try to figure out how do we make things happen? Because if we make it better for one of us in that model, we make it better for all of us.
Exactly.
And And if we work only in an atmosphere of competition, then we all lose.
Right. And for example, in the area of promoting better mental health services in our community, who wants to fight over that? Like, we all want to make it better for everybody, right?
Right. Uh-huh. Absolutely right. Well, as always, Angelo, it's great to talk to you. Can I just mention a book?
Sure.
This is a very, very sobering book, but I think it's a very important book. Came out in August by Isabel Wilkerson, who is a reporter for New York Times, who has written very cogently. She had a marvelous book a few years ago about the African-American diaspora called The Warmth of Other Suns. But she had a book come out in August called Caste, C-A-S-T-E, where she looks at the issue of the situation that we have in the United States and compares it, I think, very compellingly to the caste system of India and in a very, you know, unflattering way, to the caste system that grew up during Nazi Germany. And I think it's so well-reasoned and so well thought out that I think it's an important book for us to understand.
Cool. Good. Thank you for sharing that.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about?
No, I just appreciate you doing these podcasts. I've been listening to them as I go on my walks in nature, and I really do value them. So thanks for having that idea, Paul. That really, you did. You were the kind of, that was your brainchild. So thank you.
No, it was this was clearly the work of a team. And also, please thank your faculty who have been so willing to jump in and, you know, let a dumb guy ask them questions. So it's been terrific, and it all hinges on the sort of institutional support that you've given. We really, really appreciate it. It's been wonderful getting to know several members of your faculty.
So truly, we're a team of teams.
Epsi. Look at us. Well, be safe. Keep up the good work, and we really appreciate everything you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.